Nobody covers dog sledding like Mushing from First Paw Media. Our team of athletes, volunteers, race organizers, and mushers like Robert and Michelle Forto brings you closer to this sport. If it's happening, we are there. Live from the qualifying races in January and February, the Iditarod in March, and in the summer, Mushing takes you on the road with our team and trail tour. We connect you with a history of this sport, in-depth interviews with the top mushers, and great storytelling and breaking news all year long. Follow on mushing.com.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert, and I am joined today by my guest returning for episode 3 of our series with Rod Perry. In our previous episodes, we did some build up to the first Iditarod, and in our last episode, the experiences on the trail. And oh my goodness, what a bunch of stories. If you have not listened to that episode, go back and take a listen, because this one is going to make much more sense. We're going to jump right back into this. We're going to talk about Rod's second and third runnings of the Iditarod. So we're back into 1974 and in 1977. And just to finish setting the scene here, after that, we have a story or two that's going to lead up to 2026. So into today's modern mushing, for sure. Rod, welcome back to the show. How's it going today?
It's going wonderfully, Robert.
I am happy to have you back. Let's jump right into this. You survived the first Iditarod. You made it back. You had a brand new Volkswagen bus. You had a sponsorship from the Volkswagen dealer with your five dogs. Everything was going well. You talked about a documentary you made called Sourdough. I'm sure that was done and in the can as they speak. What in the world made you think, I've got to do this again?
That, I'm glad you brought that last sentence up, because the prelude to the second one occurred during the first. There were maybe three kinds of people: the inept, the unprepared, the unready, the unlucky. Some got sick, had to drop out right off the bat in the first Iditarod. Then there were those who made it all the way, divided into two groups. Some said, "Man, I'm glad I did it, but I would never do it again." Kind of like my uncle, who was a Japanese, a prisoner, said he would rather die than go through that again, but he wouldn't give $1 million for the experience. And so that was me. I couldn't wait to do it again. A bunch of the rest of us were the same way. We learned so much on that first race. The learning curve was so doggone steep. It was almost straight up all the way along, fighting this doggone sled of mine. And by the way, your viewers might be very interested in Googling four words: Antiques Roadshow Iditarod Sled. That'll show them the most famous dog sled in the world, which was giving me all those problems.
Okay.
But anyway, I was designing every single tiny feature on a brand new kind of sled that I would build. And many of those features are the same that I use today in building a sled. And so, you know, my cooking method had a huge revamp, especially the food that I would take for the dogs. And the runners, instead of steel shod runners, plastic shod, and on and on, all of these things that I had learned and wanted to put into play, how to train the dogs better, and certainly the makeup of the second team, way, way better dogs. They were still making my movie, and would be for a couple more years, and I didn't have any money to put into it, but I was able to look and find a number of better dogs to add to my really good five that I had the first year. And so with that, went to the line for the second Iditarod. That first one had been the veritable Lewis and Clark expedition of the Iditarod, a voyage of discovery into the unknown. The races second through a number would be equivalent to covered wagon train trips over the Oregon Trail leading up to today's Skibblefield NASCAR, which is like an auto race between Independence, Missouri and Astoria, Oregon. But anyway, so taking off on that second race, one of the big things I had was about 500 booties. And instead of having to hand sew every bootie that I used on the first race out of a duffel bag that I found, just the team was so much better. I'd gone from averaging about 5.5 miles an hour up to 6.5 miles an hour, and I felt like I was flying.
Yeah, even that 1 mile an hour can make a big difference. Even in today's Iditarod, you look at the finishers' times and you see, you know, guys running 8 miles an hour and then guys running 7 miles an hour, over 1,000 miles. That 1 mile an hour can really add up. Rod, quickly, a couple of questions before we're on the trail here. You talked about your difference in gear and changing up of things, your cooking method and all of that sort of stuff. First question is, what was the year, and I may be going a little ahead of myself here, that we talked about this guy a couple of times in the previous episode, Bud Smith. What was the year he was cruising down Anchorage with the stovepipe out and all that? What year was that? Do you remember?
That would have been in the late 70s.
So okay, so a little bit later.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. What about old Fat Albert? Did he make the team on run number two?
Yes, he did. Yeah, he was key to that. I could not have left him home if I'd wanted to. He was sponsored by the National Observer. By the end of the run, with the National Observer and Wall Street Journal, they said the articles had gone out to 168 newspapers around the nation, and 12 weeks straight, they reported that they had more written response to those articles than anything else in the history of the National Observer. And in second place, this gives you the idea of how big it was. In second place, Watergate.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
And so it was a huge phenomenon. And then Sports Illustrated the next year came up and did an article, and about, I think, two-fifths of the first article in Sports Illustrated, about two-fifths of it were comprised with stuff about Fat Albert and so forth. Article was called Pool North to Nome.
Oh man. And that harkens way back to, you know, the stories of Jack London and all those guys. I know I didn't ask you about this before we recorded, but have you seen the movie Iron Will, the Disney movie?
Yeah.
Your story sounds like the plot line for that movie. Did you have any part in that at all? Cause my goodness, everything you're saying sounds exactly like that story.
Kind of, sort
of. Well, of course, it's Disney.
It's a nice little movie to watch. It's more like the old Winnipeg to St. Paul races, so with Emile Saint-Godard and those guys.
Yep.
But anyway, yeah, it doesn't have much resemblance to any Iditarod.
No, and I bring that up for a couple of reasons. Number one, they talk a lot about the newsman. He's a big-time character in that movie, and of course he's writing about the kid and his dogs and all that. And just a personal aside, I saw that movie in 1994. I had one Siberian, his name was Axel, and I saw that movie, Rod, and within a couple of months I had a team of sled dogs, and I thought for sure I was going to be the next Iron Will. And I met my wife Michelle. I know you've spoken to her a couple of times. We met on a America Online chat room. And we met on a Saturday afternoon, and she was asking questions, and she said, "What do you do for a living?" I said, "I'm a dog musher." And then she says, "Really? I don't know much about that." I said, "Have you ever seen the movie Iron Will?" And she said, "Yeah, I saw it with my kids." And I said, "Well, that is me." And as they say, Rod, the rest is history. But let's get back to your story here. You're on the starting line. You have Fat Albert on the line there. Your gear is much better. You have a little bit of money in your pocket, I assume, from a sponsor or two, from, you know, all the hubbub that's going on. But you said in the first episode or second episode of our series that every race after that was not the same. Set the scene for us there. You're on the trail in 1974. What was the same and what was different?
Well, now you've got a group of guys that know what they're doing.
Right.
And there's information out there. Those that want to come into the race have somebody to go to ask questions. And so it was, there was much more of a prepared group. It was a bigger group. And for the first time, there were a couple of women in the field. And for the first time, someone from outside. And we head out, and probably one of the great, most noteworthy things about that first race, maybe the most noteworthy, was the great 50-50 storm at the top of the Alaska Range. Of course, the first five races did not go through Rainy Pass. We took Ptarmigan Pass. And in that pass, the weather that had been blustery and really cold all of a sudden turned horrible. We're going along, and these gusts would hit, and they had been hitting for a couple of days. And by the way, this passage through to McGrath doesn't happen in a couple of days like it does today. On that first race, it took me 12 days to reach McGrath. But anyway, on this second race, we get up there, and all of a sudden, a huge blast hits, and I go, holy smoke, where did that come from? And I thought maybe it was some kind of a weird one-off, and then all of a sudden they started following, and it was a strange phenomenon, because usually when the wind blows, the ambient temperature comes up, whereas the chill factor may go down, but the wind stirs that ice, that really ultra cold air that has settled during calm times down along the Earth's surface. It stirs it up with winds aloft, air aloft, and this time it didn't happen. It was about 50 below zero, and the wind over 50 miles an hour. It stayed that way for 3 nights and 2 days. And I had been so careful booting my dogs in those terribly cold temperatures. We used to tape the boots on. The best tape was Scotch 88, and with a lot of bare hands, and then sometimes mittens hand, it took forever. And I got behind that doggone storm, and there piled up 9 teams behind me. I was the only one with a lead dog that would keep facing into the wind and keep going. Tony Baluta from Lake Clark had another one, and that dog would go for a little ways, and none of the rest of the leaders would do anything but turn with the wind. And so I was leading, and finally I got to a point, and I said, listen, I've been through before. None of you guys have. We are not making it through tonight. I'm shutting it down. You can do whatever you want. I'm shutting it down. I found a little place to get the dogs slightly out of the wind, and I had a tent that I had customized that the thermos company had me testing. I had customized where I could put it up in probably 2 minutes. And I got Terry Adkins to help me. That was the first year he ran the race. And we set that up and climbed inside. The next day, the weather was the same. We retreated back to Rainy Pass Lodge and waited for the winds to abate. The other guys had made it over to a little patch of forest at Hell's Gate on the upper Kuskokwim, built fires and stayed hunkering down there until the winds let up and they took off. But they were actually some of them took off in that bad weather that wasn't as bad down on the other side. And I lost 3 days right there. Then I got to McGrath and got a real bum steer on the trail. Not the fault of the checker. He said, Rod, there have been so many people going out and taking a wrong trail, a premature left-hand trail, and coming back in after hours. Do not turn left until you come to 2 dead snow machines beside the trail that have been there most of the winter. Then the trail turns left and crosses the river, and don't turn left prematurely. So I left just before dark. There was a fog. I could not even see my lead dog. A few miles up the Takotna, the dogs tried to go left. I stopped And there was no dead snow machines, and there were two trails. I got down on my hands and knees. There were dog tracks both ways. I said, well, this has to be the premature bad trail. And I took the other one. Remy Reddington had been leading the whole Iditarod race by 11 hours. He took that trail before I did and lost out. And I took the trail, spent a whole night on that trail. It turned out to be a trap line trail. I came back into McGrath in the daylight. And so happened that the checker had not known the guy that owned the snow machines had gone up the day before and pulled them out before ice out in the spring. Well, there goes another day. I get to Ruby. I left in a blizzard, and I go down and, not being able to see, took a wrong trail up the Yuki River. I thought it was going around behind an island. Well, it wasn't going behind any island. I lost almost another day right there. So about 5 days of lost running. You know, you're using up the team's energy and wasting time. And so anyway, I ended up finishing 14th in that one. I had such a much better team than a number of the teams ahead of me. I remember passing five teams the last day of the race.
So and, 14 position there in Iditarod number two. We talked about the money at the end of the last one, $700, I think you said. What did you take home for number two? Do you remember?
$341.
Oh, my goodness. Less than...
Atlantic Richfield had pulled out on us. They pulled the rug out from under us sponsor-wise right like during the last few days before the race.
Okay.
What we did not know is that there was a member of the board with Atlantic Richfield that was on the national board of, I think, the Humane Society. And nobody up here had any idea that they should be writing letters in support of the race. But what happened is they got a few letters, something like seven letters from people talking about cruelty to animals. And so from out of nowhere, they pulled their sponsorship. And at the Mushers meeting, George Outlaw, of course, being the king of sprint racing and very into the prize money, said, you know, the people of Alaska follow this race because I'm in it. And I want to make sure that first prize stays the same. And he kind of forced everybody's hand, really. And everybody says, okay, we'll keep first prize at $12,000 the way it was part of the $50,000 split the year before. And the rest of us had to live on whatever was left. And so I got less for, you know, about half for 14th than I had gotten for 17th the year before.
Interesting. And there's a lot of dog mushing politics that you just said in that stanza right there with sponsors pulling out and animal rights and all that thing. We still see that today. So you finished up number two. We're going to fast forward in the interest of time. We're going to jump to 1977 now. This is your third Iditarod. Quick question. Why did it take you 3 years to make it back to the trail? Was it a money thing? Was it a dog thing? A little bit of everything? And then tell us briefly about that third running and why was that your last one?
I was making my motion picture, and by then I had quite a few investors. And there was a lot of pressure. Get the doggone movie finished, Rod. Quit running that race. And also my brother wanted to run, and we had such a little tiny kennel and such a poor boy operation that we would pool resources. So while I lay out and worked on my movie, I helped him get ready and run the Iditarod. That sled that we built for him is still one of the most gorgeous sleds ever built for the Iditarod. And so anyway, he went out and he wasn't near the dog man I was, but he always did better than I did. He finished, I think the worst he ever finished was 13th, and he finished in the top 10. So he ran the third and fourth Iditarod, and I ran the fifth.
What's his first name, Rod?
Alan.
Alan Perry. Okay. We're going to link to all of this in the notes.
Yeah. Yeah. So, anyway, that's why I lay out and got the motion picture finished. I finally got a little bit of money to put into, building a dog team. And I had a dream breeding that I wanted to put together. I didn't own either of the dogs, but I approached Isaac Oklisic of Teller and leased his great lead dog, Black, took her to pre-arranged breeding with Riley's puppy up in Nenana. And doggone if I didn't hit a bingo, because the next year, amazingly, Puppy won the Gold Harness Award. The year after that, Black won it. Who could have, I mean, out of thousands and thousands of Alaska dogs that Iditarod teams are chosen from, and then out of the hundreds on each team from which a Golden Harness winner is chosen, I hit the next two.
Wow.
And out of that breeding, I got a fantastic dog that never got to run the Iditarod. And out of her, the first breeding with her, I got another Gold Harness winner that Dean Osmer bought from me as a puppy. The famous Dean Osmer, Rod Perry, set net skiff for three puppy trade. And those, as Dean says in the book, Icons of the Iditarod by Jeff Schultz, those dogs made up the foundation to, his dog teams. So anyway, one of the others of that litter I gave to Joe Reddington, and that dog became the best dog on his dog team, acknowledged by himself and Susan Butcher, the best dog he had for several Iditarods. So that I was starting to build a really, really good dog team, but actually that I'm jumping too far ahead. That came after my 77 race. On the 77 race, I put together one whale of a dog team. But due to some circumstances and in some ways a lack of knowledge about some things, I had that team diminished by the time of the race to half itself, and I had to borrow some dogs from Chester Topcock up in Teller, who had been training for the rendezvous, then decided he was not going to be able to race, and he hadn't had those dogs in continued training for several weeks. So I was able to stay either in the lead briefly or up near the lead all the way to the Caltag Portage, and then dropped back. I had my brother's leader, and he kind of quit on me and started dawdling. And I ended up back in 19th place, the worst I ever did.
So finished the 77 race in 19th place. We've been talking about money over the last couple of episodes. Do you remember the payout for number 19?
I don't. I've got that trophy here on my bookshelf, and I never have valued it very much.
Okay.
I was so disgusted. I have a character flaw of dwelling too much. I'm getting better at it as I age, but shoulda, coulda, woulda, if I'd only, and dwelling too much in that. And I ran that whole race so frustrated and so disappointed. I really didn't have any fun hardly. And by the way, I was the second person ever into Iditarod in the modern era behind Swenson. But anyway,
yeah.
Faded back from there.
So you finished in 19th, right? You said?
Yeah.
In 19th place. Here we are, 1977. We're 4 years into the race right now. Did you know at that point this was going to be your last one? We talked about earlier, and this is common in dog mushing, is there's a lot of people that are one and done. They do it for the experience, the bucket list, whatever you want to call it. But here you are finishing your third, Did you know this was the last one at that point?
No, I didn't. Again, I didn't have really much fun, but I was starting to put together that dream breeding and taking off on a finally having some money to breed up a team that would be competitive. And I had a cataclysm occur in my life that I won't get into. And it just knocked the foundations right out from under me. And I had to slap myself in the face and say, Rod, listen, you've got to reevaluate where you're going in life. This race is eating you up. Anybody that observes me today and sees my absolute dedication to the Iditarod, near fanaticism, can hardly help but imagine what it must have been back then.
Yeah.
As a younger competitive guy. But I realized, doggone, you don't have a family. You don't have kids. You don't have a business of your own. All these things that I wanted. And you are making money in construction and things in the summertime. I'd work these camp jobs out in the bush and pile up the overtime and make big money and on the Trans-Alaska pipeline. Then you're spending it all with this goofy race in the winter. You got to get out of it. So I didn't put it all together at first. I kind of thought I was sort of lapsing back, and I started leasing my team out. The most notable lease was the year Dean Osmar won. I leased the team to Bob Toll, one of his crewmen on his SetNet site. And as they would train together every day down out of Kasiloff, my team would beat Dean's every day. But on the race, Bob wasn't near the experienced competitor that Dean was. And Dean won in an amazing run where he never saw another musher after New Lotto. Nothing like that solo run has ever happened again. And Bob's team was better than Dean's, but Bob ended up finishing, I think, something like 21st. He ended up passing 13 teams right at the end of the race. So anyway, from there, you know, I leased the team out, and I finally decided it's time to just sell them. So I sold the dogs and got completely out of Iditarod. I made myself stay away for a quarter century.
Mm.
And when I finally got to retirement age, I thought, what can I do with the rest of my life that would be productive, something I'm good at, and something where I can give back? And the Iditarod had become so much of my identity. I owed it so much that I heeded Joe Reddington's dying wish. For the sake of the people of Alaska and the dogs, please don't let my race die. And so I set myself on that course and began by writing my two books, Trailbreakers, Pioneering Alaska's Iditarod. Volume one is about how the trail was born. I'd been named by the Secretary of the Interior, Cecil Andrus, under Carter, to the very first Iditarod National Historic Trails Advisory Council. And so I wrote that one about the trail. The second is the race that runs over the trail, about how the first race was brought off. And there's amazing stuff in there that almost no one knows about today. For instance, how the prize money was gleaned from the blackmail of a very prominent Alaskan. And so anyway, I started my stint down on the Avenue, being a volunteer Iditarod ambassador to our city summer visitors. By now, I've gone past 100,000. I'm moving up toward 150,000 who have stopped at that kiosk over the years since 2009. And I'm on the board of directors, of course, for the emerging Anchorage Mushing District.
Rod, don't spoil that yet, because that's in our last episode. But I want to step back pretty quickly here before we run out of time. You had mentioned there, we're back to 1977-ish now, and you said you pretty much outlined a dog musher's life. We put all of our money, we put all of our time, we neglect everything, family, business, all of that to do this crazy thing. I've told the story for years. I moved to Alaska to chase that crazy Iditarod dream. And so many people have gone down that route. The same exact route that you have talked about. It took you a long time, like you said, you were out of the race, so to speak, for 25 years before you jumped back into it. That had to, it consumes you, doesn't it? That's the easiest word to describe, just this lifestyle and this craziness of the sport and lifestyle of dog mushing, isn't it?
Yeah. And by the way, just about the time I was finally getting out of it, in fact, the winter that I finally sold off the last dog, I was in Fairbanks and Leroy Shank and I mean, there's nobody that should be called father of the Yukon Quest but Leroy.
Right.
But I had introduced him to dog driving, and I knew a lot more about how a race should be put together. So I spent the winter with Leroy, and he often said later the Yukon Quest race was put together right over there. He'd motioned to his kitchen table, and so he and I and we added a couple others and went to White Horse to break the news to the Canadians. And so I'm the second most important co-founder to the Yukon Quest, and a lot of the rules were my rules that characterized that race.
Yeah, and a lot of people that follow dog mushing are familiar with the Quest, more common fans, especially today since it hasn't been around in the last 5 or so years. It's becoming a little bit more forgotten in sort of the history of dog mushing, sadly. But to finish this up, Rod, bringing us up to today, we're going to talk in our next episode about the work that you're doing, post today. One question, and you can say as much or as little as you want about this, how has the Iditarod changed since that, that first few years?
Changed in all kinds of ways. I'm asked this more than any other question at my kiosk. Well, next to where's the famous starting line? Now we've got that arch to show. And the second one is where's Balto? Mm-hmm. Thinking the statue. But anyway, how has it changed? Well, at first, it was a ragtag bunch of guys that, there was nothing standardized whatsoever. We had to learn. And gradually, we found out what worked, what kind of dogs were best. The dogs started to be bred right and resulting in these amazing, amazing dogs today, where most of the litters from top to bottom are competitive, athletic Iditarod dogs. Everybody's got a good dog team today. And so that has changed. How to run the race, how to fuel your animals has changed, how to train them. And just on and on, the equipment and so forth. One thing that you see today is the lack of real characters. These guys aren't, people that are coming out of the bush, all kinds of guys like Charlie Boulding, and of course, the lack of native drivers is just so sad. You don't have them. It's kind of standardized into a group of professional dog drivers. They're just people that pick it up in their youth, decide upon the course of action, or maybe they pick it up a little bit older, but they fit into the mold of the current racers and learn from them. And it's just a professional set. I have often said they wouldn't have a clue on that first Iditarod where they're all alone for a huge part of the race and have to rely on their survival moxie. I'm afraid if a lot of the field today were on the first Iditarod, there would have left quite a few dead along the way. That may be an exaggeration, but it's not too far from it.
Well, just to jump in on that, Rod, obviously everything in our lifestyle has changed just in a general sense. Even in my days, I mean, we spent all of our time outside. We didn't spend time on computers and, you know, we weren't worried about the internet. We weren't worried about what everybody thought of us. We just did things, you know, growing up in the 70s and, of course, in the 80s and all that. So, yeah, heck of a lot has changed over the years. Rod, I used to ask my guests two questions, and I'm interested to hear what you have to say. I've changed that up a little bit to get a little bit more flavor when I asked you last week about your favorite song and your gear and your snacks, but I'm interested in hearing these two. Can I ask them to you to end the show?
Can I wedge in? That,
yeah, go for it.
Today there's all kinds of electronic hand holding.
Yep.
Out there, and the traffic on the trail. Also, the teams are condensed. The field is compressed, so you always have help. And anything that might occur to you, you've got people coming along. And the big, big thing back then was covering the distance, how to make that next quarter mile ahead of you. When there was no trail, perhaps you're having to snowshoe, or you're looking, you're trying to find the trail. And now it's any fool could follow the trail with all of the marking and so forth. And the grooming and the condensed field. And so it's not a matter of, can I make this next 2 miles? It's, you know, how to jockey for position. It's really like NASCAR. The first races were like the Mexican road race. Now it's kibble fueled NASCAR.
Yeah. I teach dog mushing at the two local universities here at UAA and APU. And I often refer it to NASCAR. We talk about, you know, the driver and the pit crew and the whole nine yards. And I make that analogy all the time. Rod, let me ask you these two questions, because I think it'll yes. finish up this episode really nicely. So the first one is, if somebody is getting involved in the sport or the lifestyle of dog mushing, they're just getting involved, what would be only one piece of advice that you would tell them? If they walked up to you and said, Rod, give me one piece of advice, what would you tell them?
You need a mentor.
Okay.
And you need to choose the right one. Don't choose Willie off the pickle boat. Go to the best you can find and see if you can attach yourself to him or her. Probably start out as a handler and then work from there. I mean, you look at all the people that have become successful racers that started that way, there's somebody in their life that they could grab a hold of their coattails and learn from. And so that would be the advice.
Perfect advice. A lot of old timers definitely say that. We've had people, you know, that's been doing this from, you know, the 70s, 60s, all the way up to today. And a lot of the old timers will say, find that mentor, be a handler, whichever. Okay, the next question is going to lead really nicely.
I should say, just for a little color.
Yep.
My dad used to say, in relation to any athletics, if you coach yourself, you've got a fool for a coach.
That is the truth for sure. I would agree with that. Okay. Next question here. I'm sure you contemplate this from time to time because you talk to, like you said, 100,000 people plus have been asking questions to you over the years. And that is, where do you see the sport of dog mushing and or the lifestyle of dog mushing in the next 5 to 10 years? And what are you quantifying that with? And I say that because, is it climate? Is it money? Is it the progression of gear? It could be positive or negative. Where do you see the sport and lifestyle of dog mushing into the next decade?
Well, first of all, we've got to find PETA-proof sponsors. And then I don't know what can be done because it appears the Iditarod Trail Committee is so closed off to any outside commentary. They don't know the race history. They were your age when the race started or younger. I have no idea of the race history. They don't have any idea of the traditions. They're very good at dealing with the mechanics and with looking for finances. Color has been lost. Romance, adventure. What am I trying to, there's a word I'm trying to come up with. But anyway, it a lot of the, drama. The head filmmaker was talking to Jesse Holmes last year, and he says, "You guys aren't giving me any storylines." Well, it's pretty much flat track NASCAR. There have to be some changes. I advanced the idea of Dan Seavey, who lamentably now we don't have access to with his passing, but Dan and Dick Mackey and me addressing the Iditarod Trail Committee over, say, an evening around the fireplace. Each one of us decries something that has destroyed, utterly destroyed, a huge part of the culture of the race. And these guys have no clue about it. They don't even know that it existed. They didn't do it. It was done before them. There was a try at remedying something that really needed to be dealt with, but the baby got thrown out with the bathwater. It took a while to see the damage that it did. And I'll just tell you right here, it's the corralling. Dick Mackey, Dan Seavey, and I know more than anyone else about, because we were the ones with the great overview. We all three started into this thing a couple years, or in the case of Mackey, more years than that, ahead of the race in the involvement with Joe Reddington and the planning. And we've seen it all. But there's no listening. And I don't know what is going to happen.
So, Rod, for folks that are listening, most of them are just casual fans. They follow Iditarod during Iditarod season, very similar to how people follow the Olympics. Nobody watches figure skating except every 4 years, right? When you say corralling is one of the big issues, to the casual fan, what does that mean? What are you trying to explain?
What happened was, as people ran Iditarod after Iditarod, they at first you could stay with the locals in their homes in a checkpoint, and they would host you there, and you'd take your dog team to their place, and they'd be in the back of their cabin, and it was just a beautiful thing, tremendous hospitality. The villagers had a race they could touch and feel and call their own. They could take ownership of it. And it was so much a matter of pride and excitement and to develop these friendships, these intimate friendships among the mushers and so forth. But what happened is, number one, the more you ran the race, the more of an in you might have with people hosting you. And any advantage that you got by that wasn't anything that was maybe available to a newbie. And so there was a kind of an imbalance and a little unfairness. And then you got a particular person that went out before the race 1 year and really, really went overboard, hyper-organizing their checkpoints like a NASCAR pit crew. And, you know, maybe tell them, hey, you'll know when I'm coming in, when I'm 2 hours out, bring my drop into the house, get the dog food heated up, and da-da-da-da-da. Well, something had to be done. So they finally came up with a ruling. If you offer anything to one person, you have to offer it to everyone. Well, a person might have room to host one person in their cabin, but they can't put 40 of them in there. And so what they did was they created a common area out on the fringe of the village, or maybe in the middle of the village where there was a big vacant spot, but a big common area where everybody kept their dogs. And now today, what you see is in a lot of, especially along the Yukon, almost nobody even pays attention when the race comes through. I was at Leroy Shanks bidding him goodbye. He was dying. And in the home there visiting was the girlfriend of the chief man at Galena. And she broke down into tears thinking I had some stroke with the Iditarod to try to fix things. She said the people of the village don't even really like the race anymore. And so maybe I shouldn't be telling this in a public forum like this, but something needs to be done. And I'm not sure what. I have some ideas the way I would try it, but to see if the villagers would, you know, kind of reclaim and become more involved in the race itself. That when I say it's lost to culture, that's a horrible thing.
You know, Rod, this is very common knowledge here on our podcast in particular. We talk about this a lot, especially the way that it is run today. So yeah, you're exactly on the same page that we talk about often. You'd mentioned there's not any drama, there's not any real coverage except for, you know, during Iditarod and all that. We are doing our darndest to keep this afloat as much as we can with our work with the magazine and all of that, and having guys like you on to tell their stories and just kind of keeping it up. To end here, last part of that question, aside from Iditarod, where do you see the future of the sport and of the lifestyle? Obviously, it's much, much more expensive now to keep a dog team. Just to keep our 30 dogs that we use, it's well over $2,000 a month just for dog food. Obviously, much more expensive than it was in your day. Where do you see it going from here? Is it micro kennels and dryland racing? Is it the romanticism of Iditarod just ran as a NASCAR race as it is? Is it the smaller races that we have even here in South Central Alaska, like the Connect 200 and, you know, races like that? Where do you see the sport as a whole, the lifestyle as a whole, as we move into the next decade?
I think that if we lose the Iditarod, the rest of it will fall like dominoes.
Okay.
It's kind of like I was in charge of all the coordination of hunter education, bow hunter education instructors for South Central Alaska for a number of years. And I was well acquainted with the try of, you know, anti-hunters to bring down hunting. They'll look for the tender underbelly. You know, they'll first go after, say, hunting bears with hounds and trapping and things like that. And then they'll go from there to bow hunting and other things. And then finally just work their way along until they bring the whole thing down. And so with the Iditarod, if they, you know, people like PETA are successful in ending the Iditarod, or the Iditarod ends itself becoming more and more expensive. And by the way, this is a horrible thing that they have knocked some of the teams that were so close to being able to finish in Nome. They knocked them out of the race and didn't let them finish just because they finished maybe a day too late. My goodness, with all of the expense and the trouble those people have put in, let them finish. I can see if somebody's just on a camping trip and he's weak back there, yeah, but not some of these people that are so close. Anyway, if that ends, I fear that then they'll go after the rendezvous, the club races. The people at the heart of PETA deem it slavery to own a dog as a pet. So most of their people don't know what the people at the core believe in. And so they'll go after, you know, just the fact that you would put dogs into a position to where they have to pull a sled.
Yep.
I just think the whole thing will topple if we let the Iditarod topple. And they better make it so that the Iditarod is more runnable and more teams will be encouraged to run that race, competitive or not.
Rod, you took a lot of the words right out of my mouth there. I second a lot of what you said. We've said that for years here on the show. Again, it is a pleasure to sit down here and talk with you. We've had three episodes here in our series. We have one left. We're going to talk about what is next for Rod and his work with the Anchorage Mushing District and the fancy arch and all of that. That is coming up on our next episode. It's going to take us into today and well into tomorrow as well. Rod, it's a pleasure. We'll talk real soon, okay?
Okay, really good. Really
Thank
good.
You. On Great. Behalf of my guest today, Rod Perry, this is Robert for the Mushing Podcast. We will see you guys next time. Goodbye.
Are you a fan of the great outdoors? Do you enjoy the thrill of speed and adventure? Then listen up. Introducing Mushing, your ultimate guide to the exciting world of dog-powered sports and mushing. Whether you're a seasoned musher or just starting out, Mushing has got you covered. Get ready to immerse yourself in captivating stories of incredible sled dog races, expert training tips from seasoned professionals, and gear reviews to help you make the right choices for your team. From the breathtaking landscapes of Alaska to the snowy trails of Scandinavia, Mushing takes you on a thrilling journey through the world of dog-powered sports. Don't miss out on the latest issue, packed with exclusive interviews with top mushers, in-depth articles on sled dog nutrition, and stunning photography that will transport you to the heart of the action. So whether you're dreaming of competing in the Iditarod or simply want to learn more about this incredible sport, Mushing is your go-to resource. Subscribe now and get ready to unleash your passion for mushing. Visit our website at mushing.com or find us on your favorite podcast platform. Mushing, where the spirit of adventure meets the power of the pack.